mailbag, John. Let me think now. I think I had a little bit of a hint as to one of the questions you're going to be asking tonight. KC2WGB with the mailbag. K2LIW in the TechNet.
W2HL.
Dick, I believe Wesley had a point on a planet or something he wanted to bring up. I think he filed for time. I'm not sure.
Okay. We're going to go to Wesley in a second. I think I heard W2HO. Mr. HO, are you giving us some further information on the subjects on hand? Mr. HO, if I got it correctly, to give you your name, K2LIW. My name is Dick.
Good evening, Dick. No, this is Howard, W2HL, high low. I just wanted to ask you a question. I lived in Rockaway Beach in Bell Harbor. When 587 hit, I was almost in my house. I was 8 blocks from there. Sort of go down. I was just listening. It's very interesting when you commented about why it went down. But you mentioned that the airline had tail strikes. I don't know what you meant by that. Did you mean it previously had been? Can you explain what those tail strikes were in a previous situation?
Yeah, the aircraft arrived with the crack in the vertical stabilizer in the material of the graphite reinforced material, and it was repaired by a procedure that I think was maybe inadequate. On either two or three occasions, the aircraft had a rough landing where the tail of the aircraft struck the concrete. And whether or not it was on landing or on takeoff, there I'm not sure. But on either two or three occasions that were reported, when you look up the FAA records on that exact aircraft or that serial number, you'll find out the tail of that aircraft struck a concrete runway on either two or three occasions. And that, in my opinion, is capable of aggravating any strength doubt of the vertical stabilizer. That's what I'm saying, Howard. W2HL, K2RIW.
Hey, thank you, Dick. Yeah, I live 8 blocks from where that crash happened. The engine, as a matter of fact, fell on, one engine fell right on gas station on 129th Street, 2 blocks from where the happened. And the engine fell right in front of the garage of the gas station, like it was sitting there. Hit any part of the structures of the gas station. Anyway, thanks for that explanation. I appreciate it. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, there's quite a bit more to that 587 flight story. The pilot had permission to take off, but he was taking off in much too short a period between the takeoff of the previous aircraft, a 747 JAL Heavy. So a very heavy aircraft took off in front of him. He didn't wait the right length of time for the horizontal cyclones, the tip vortices of the previous aircraft to die down. He flew the exact same path as the previous aircraft, slightly below the previous aircraft, which is all the wrong thing to do. So you're going to run into those horizontal cyclones coming off the wing of the previous aircraft. And he tried correcting by using lots of rudder control, and eventually the rudder left the airplane, and the airplane flew sideways so violently that the engine got ripped off of the pylon. And when you rip an engine off a pylon, it comes off with a very loud bang as there's very strong bolts break. People on the ground hearing that sound thought they were hearing the sound of an explosion. There was no pyrotechnics on board, so there was no explosion. But that was a pretty wicked accident. Were you at home at that incident of time, or where were you located during that actual incident, Howard? W2HL, K2RIW.
I was home at the time, and I recall that I heard a very loud noise screeching. I assumed that, the loud screeching, I assumed it was the Concorde, because Concorde had resumed flights for a period of time, right around the time of the crash. So I assumed it was that, and then the screech, instead of the loud noise of the Concorde fading away, it just like it was a complete silence, and then all of a sudden a boom, and my whole house shook, lights went out, and I opened the door to see what happened, and it looked like a mushroom crop, a cloud. It was really something. Quite uneasy situation, but thank God it didn't hit. But a lot of people, there weren't that many people, about five people that were killed, drowned, I believe, two in their house. Back to you, Dick, W2HL.
Now, one last question, Howard. Because that 587 disaster occurred a short period of time, I believe it was after 9/11, I'm guessing that for a short period of time, people had a rumor that this was another terrorist act. Was that the stated briefly around that period of time? Thank you, Howard, KQLIW.
Everybody thought it was a terrorist attack. Giuliani came down, and the FBI were knocking on doors all over the neighborhood, and cell phone and the infrastructure of was completely knocked out. Nobody could make phone calls. But that was the consensus at that time. I don't recall exactly when they I think they were able to determine right away that it wasn't a terrorist attack. There were some people that saw some people in the area that actually saw flames coming out of the cabin. Some eyewitnesses. So I don't know if that if that would go along with the findings. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, fuel was being pumped into both of those engines, Hal. Without the vertical stabilizer, the airplane at 280 knots or whatever it was flying started flying sideways. The wind hitting the engines sideways ripped them off the pylons of the wing. So fuel being pumped into an engine that has just been ripped off of a wing. So that could be a source of fire that people would see. So was there any additional fire in the cabin? I guess we'll never know because when that struck the ground, obviously an awful lot of damage of what you would like to investigate is going to take place. Now, most cell phone systems, the base station has backup batteries. Even though your local power failed, I'm kind of amazed that your cell phones failed. If the aircraft did not strike a cell site, and almost all cell sites are backed up with batteries, did anybody come up with an explanation for why you couldn't make cell phone calls? And so how long did that persist, Hal? Were you able to make cell phone calls some number of hours later? W2HL, K2LIW.
Well, I think it was, I think the general consensus was of the extreme amount of traffic of people falling into the area of Rockaway. So I think it was just busy, overcrowded lines that caused the overload. I don't think there was an actual malfunction by anything hit.
My guess is when those engines and our aircraft struck the ground, you probably felt a pretty loud thud in your house, almost as if there was an earthquake. Is that true, Hal?
This is Howard, or Howie. Oh, yeah. It felt like an earthquake. And I'm 8 blocks from where the crash happened. I'm on 139th Street. The crash was on 131. And it shook the house. The house shook. So, back to you, W2HL.
Yeah, sorry, I called you something else. Howard, thank you for that information. Wes, I think you wanted to bring something to our attention. N2XJN, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Cirrus, the dwarf planet, we are pretty close right now, and north of the river, beautiful Flores. I have a very simple question. However, it's not that simple. How many planets do we have in our solar system? Back to you first.
Okay, I think you said you have a question about the new planet that they believe is in the Kuiper Belt or Oort cloud. I'm not sure which. I think it's the Kuiper Belt. So they have reason to believe there's a new planet. That's the subject you said you wanted to discuss. You said you had a question. Over to you, Hal. I mean, Wes.
Well, I would like to briefly discuss the subject. So, to make that conversation even more interesting, I ask you the question. How many planets do we have in our solar system?
That's a trick question. We used to think it was 9. And because Pluto got downgraded to a minor planetismal or whatever, we think there's 8. And the total number of planets really that are circling our particular sun, I guarantee the number is unknown. We know that there are other objects in the Kuiper Belt or the Oort cloud, I think it's the Kuiper Belt, which are larger than Pluto. That is the reason that Pluto got downgraded. And so I don't know the number, but I'm reasonably assured that in the rest of our lifetime, the total number of planets going around our sun that are recognized is going to increase. I think we can say that for sure. The number is going to increase. And whether or not the newly discovered objects are large enough to fit the criteria that has recently been enacted as a definition of planet is another interesting thing to discuss. But the total number of objects in orbit around our sun is a very large number of objects. I think you can say that for sure. And now we're into an academic area as to which of those are big enough to be declared as planets as we do further analysis of them. N2XJN, K2RAW.
Okay, N2XJN. Here's the largest object in the asteroid belt and the smallest known dwarf planet. It's 590 miles. I like better kilometers. 950 kilometers, if it was me, I would restrict usage of Imperial system. Anyhow, its orbit between Mars and Jupiter takes about 4.6 Earth years to complete. And the day on Sirius is 9 hours and 4 minutes long. Let me try. There are a few interesting information about that. It recently became possible to get high-quality images that are transmitted to the Earth, and they give a lot of information about the surface of the Sirius. But interesting enough is, think about it. Imagine that you have a sphere that is 950 kilometers in diameter, or miles, 590. Or 950 grams, right? And imagine that you compare it with the Earth. Could you think about that thing containing more drinking water than all of the drinking water in the planet Earth? Back to you.
Yeah, that is within the range of possibility. One of the theories that I've read is that the water on the Earth was deposited here by comets and asteroids. So this asteroid that you're now mentioning could, under certain conditions, in its lifespan, have more water than us. Could have a thicker layer of water. And thank goodness that that object appears to never be on a collision path with Earth. If something 590 miles in diameter ever collided with Earth, that would be an extremely significant event. There are some near-Earth objects out there that some people worry about. Will they ever strike us? And they, from time to time, will ask the question, should we start creating hardware that is capable of deflecting these objects, near-Earth objects, if we have enough forewarning that an impact is going to take place sometime in the future? ONUS, N2XJN, K2RAW.
Okay. Sirius may have a thin atmosphere and possibly an ocean of water beneath its surface. So, but Earth that doesn't have any water outside, or not much of it, but it does have plenty surface. So no one could live unprotected on the surface, but scientists still don't know what is the temperature and what is the condition on the surface of the planet. So it is thought that it could be a mining field for the water for the future astronauts to create oxygen on and rocket fuel. Interesting information. Gravity is a very small one. So comparing to, let's say, take the number of the gravity of one, if Earth is one, then Sirius gravity would be 0.28,000, or 0.028. Temperature, quite cold over there. It is a minus 73 degrees of Celsius, trying to give you in Fahrenheit, 100 degrees of Fahrenheit in minus. That would be the temperature in the planet. And some interesting information. Not much interested with all of the stuff, although they discovered light. They don't have the explanation for the light on the planet. They found at least two of them, but one very much significant in the middle of the crater. Now think about it, crater, but you have a huge amount of water beneath. So, it is in form of ice, definitely, and then you have a soil. I was more interested with the scientific instrumentation they have, and before I go there, back to you, and to Xia.
WS2N.
Yeah, on a couple of occasions you called it a planet, and I think Sirius is an asteroid. Let's see what the poll for the fan is. WS2N, K2RAW, go ahead, poll.
The latest theory on the bright spots on Sirius is that it's probably the salt concentration within the last couple of days. Yeah, they're getting the information from the Dawn spacecraft, which is still presently orbiting that dwarf planet. And that was discovered in the 18, just a year after the turn of the century, 1801. And the actual, he started calling that a planet that got downgraded. But now it's joined the dwarf planet group like Pluto and Sedna and some of the other ones that are out there in the Kuiper Belt. But the bright spot is what I wanted to comment on is the latest theory is the salt content. It's a salt deposit. Back to you.
Paul, I think you've told us in the past, and I'm forgetful. Did we send a spacecraft to that vicinity? And is there a future spacecraft going to go there? And I'd like to believe that James Webb Space Telescope, when it deploys, is going to give us some more information. So what spacecraft have we put near this heavenly body? WS2N, K2RIW?
That's the Dawn spacecraft, presently in orbit. Only about a couple hundred miles above the surface right now. Eventually it's going to go in lower, start about 900 miles out, and then work its way closer over time. So the Dawn spacecraft is the one that was launched how many years ago, probably about 7 years ago. It first went out to the asteroid Vista, orbited it for about 15 months, and then out of orbit and went on to the asteroid Sirius. That's where Wesley's getting the information from, the Dawn spacecraft, picking up all the info. So, yeah, that's the spacecraft with the ion engines. It's got three ion engines on board and still working, still functioning. Back to you, Dick.
Since they are in a descending orbit flight plan right now, how close do they intend to get? And I'm guessing they do not intend to land on the surface. Is that true, Paul? Go ahead.
No landing is planned. And I think they're going to go down eventually to the 30-mile area. Go. Naturally, they start up higher and work their way closer. So, the final mission will just be to leave it in orbit. They don't have enough fuel on board to deorbit. So eventually it will someday hit the surface. But, you know, it's been a long time. It's equivalent to an exosphere. You know, there's nothing really to slow it down in orbit. It's not like a couple hundred miles above the Earth. Eventually it would deorbit. Back to you, Dick.
I'm going to guess that Dawn has got a good high-resolution telescope giving us some nice pictures. As we get closer to that asteroid, the resolution will improve. Is Dawn powered by solar panels or by nuclear? I'm going to guess it's solar panels. So therefore, it's not going to run out of power. I guess end of life is defined when it no longer has, I think it's xenon gas in order to run its ionic engine. And is there also a consumable fuel that does the orientation to keep the solar cells aimed at the sun and to keep the antenna aimed at the Earth? WS2N, K2LIW.
You gotta have hydrazine thrusters, like many spacecraft, but the main propulsion has been the three ionic engines. And they never fire it, you know, all at once, it's one at a time. Actually, they pretty much use two engines and the third with the backup. The craft is run on solar panels. I think the total length of the panels is about 60 feet, 30 feet on each side, something like that. Picking up enough sun energy, even out in the asteroid belt, to the batteries charge, which eventually are used for the ion engines. I think that's about it. Oh, the other question was, is there any other planned mission to go to Sirius? Right now there's not, but of course, eventually there will be. Like Wesley says, eventually they'll have astronauts there, and maybe they'll use it as a refueling station, along with many other locations in the solar system that they know have water. They can, you know, set up a system to that water for fuel, oxygen for the fuel, and also to breathe. Who knows? They have a sci-fi show on. We've got one night, it's on. It's called The Expanse, and they're actually, they have people living inside Sirius a couple hundred years from now. Back to you, Dick.
I think Sirius is an object in the asteroid belt. I think the asteroid belt is a belt between Mars and Jupiter. So it's a greater astronomical units than Mars, but less than Jupiter. So, not much sunlight out there, but 60-foot solar panel. Wow, that's a biggie. And I guess you're saying that we believe there's a lot of water there, but at those kind of temperatures, it's in frozen form. In frozen form, it's not as exciting to go there with a spacecraft and drill a hole and look for life. Life to form under those environmental conditions is not so favorable. That's a guess on my part. Is that approximately what NASA is saying on this? And have they said whether or not James Webb will also be looking at this object? Although maybe with Dawn being that close with a good telescope, maybe Dawn's going to give us higher resolution than we could ever get with James Webb. For the WS2N, K2RIW, go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, you're not going to beat Dawn. You know, you get that close to a heavenly body, and you're not going to beat that. And I don't know, maybe Wesley knows if the theory is that there could be liquid water all the way down underneath. Maybe, I don't know. I haven't heard that story yet. But maybe he had read that. side, Cuban side?
I don't know.
Back to you, Dick. I'll stand by. I know we've got to stand by eventually. John, of course I have a space report as well. Back to you, WS1.
When it comes to your space report, we want to try to align your antenna a little bit better, Paul. The signal's a little bit noisy tonight. And so, there being life on Sirius is not so likely in my mind. PBS has had a number of programs about extreme organisms that will live under the ice of Antarctica or the Arctic, Antarctica in particular. There are organisms that will live on the bottom side of the ice because they're getting enough energy of the sunlight that shines through the ice or way out there in that asteroid belt. The total amount of sunlight that can get through that ice on top and support living organisms underneath makes it a bit discouraging. So I wonder if they said any words along these lines, Wes. N2XJM, K2RIW.
The signal, by the way, Dick. Found a different input. WS1.
About equal to the other one, but when it comes to the space report, you and I will run a series of experiments as to which one's the best one and what's the best way to aim the antenna. Wes, I'm guessing that what you've read about Dawn didn't say that they have hope of finding life there, even though there's water. Is that approximately true? N2XJN, K2RIW.
Well, you can think about it from different perspectives. One of them is that although the gravity of that dwarf planet is small, the magnetic field is quite significant. And then you think about drinking water on that planet, the amount greater than in the planet Earth. And then you think about it that you have a rocky core that ice is around, and then on the top of that you have a soil that will be the crust. And the crust actually is trimmed by the meteorites and whatever the activity was there. Now we can think about it whether it is solely because of the volcanic activity that was in the past year, or it's solely because of the impact of other solar bodies. Let me drop. Now, 77 degrees in minus of Celsius is not that bad. You have a dead in Siberia, and you still have a living organism and the people and the animals being there during the winter time. Yeah, it's hard to believe for the people living in Florida. Anyhow, I was mostly interested with the scientific instrumentation that they have there. They have a VIR instrument, which is the infrared spectrometry device. The history is that it was about 7 years. That was the first mission to asteroid Vesta. And then Dawn spacecraft finally got into the planet Earth, and it's going to stay there. So the mission is actually planned to have that VIR, imaging spectrometer, on board Dawn. That would take constant information. I would love Paul to correct me if my information are correct. That spacecraft gonna stay permanently on the orbit of the Sirius. Paul.
Yeah, that's what I heard, Wesley. It's not gonna leave the orbit. It can't. Doesn't have enough power. Back to you, Dick.
From what you know, Paul, what additional information do they hope to get from Dawn in orbit around Sirius? As they get closer, they're going to get higher resolution pictures of the surface. Are there any other measuring apparatus on board Dawn that can give us any other information about what's going on below the surface? WS2N, K2RIW. And how long... The mission is due to end when? The mission's funded for the next 4 years, so to speak, over to you, Paul?
No, I think they just got another year left. I'm not sure. It was supposed to be a year and a half orbit around Sirius, unless they decide to extend it. So we'll see. No, I'm not sure about the scientific instruments that are on board. You know, I know about the camera and all, but I don't remember. You know, I know every spacecraft that we send out, every robotic spacecraft, they tend to have at least 7 or 8 or different instruments on board, and they're all very similar. You know, neutron detectors. You know, they detect the sun's rays hitting the planet, and they can tell how many neutrons or something coming off of it. You know, what the elements are, and you know, this type of thing. They're all very kind of similar. I'd have to look up the details and find out, you know, how many. I think Dawn has 6 or 7 instruments on board, but which ones I can't remember. Back to you, Dick.
So, from what you know, no major reports about further information about that asteroid is due. In other words, we've discovered almost everything we have. It sounds to me like Dawn is one of the first spacecraft that made significant use of ion engines. So I guess Dawn essentially proved that ion engines are effective, high in efficiency, somewhat dependable. I think you said there's 3 of them on board. And is there something consumable about an ionic engine other than the fuel you put into it? Is there a cathode that wears out? Why were there 3 engines? If I understand correctly, only 2 of them have been used so far. If there was enough fuel, could the ion engine be used for a hell of a lot longer time? Give us a few words on that one, Paul. WF2N, K2LAW.
Just to get where they were going, they would fire that engine for, you know, 6 months, 8 months, 12 months. You just don't shut these things off. It's unbelievable. They keep accelerating at such a slow pace. So, but when they went around orbit around Vista, first asteroid, you know, they set themselves up for an extremely high elliptical orbit. So it took a long time to eventually circularize that orbit. And then they deorbited that after a year and a half and went off to Sirius. And then, they haven't been using the ion engines really all that much lately, you know, unless they're going to drop in orbit, which they're going to do again. So, and then the 3 engines were set at, I think, some 30 or 40 degrees apart from one another, you know. So they tend to don't maneuver the spacecraft in such a way before they ignite the ion engine to, you know, change trajectory, that type of thing. They do a lot of that. But if you look at this picture, you can see that the engines aren't coming out parallel to one another. They're angled to one another. Pretty extreme angles, too. Back to you, Dick.
Paul, are those ion engines steerable? Are they mechanically steerable? Because if not, what stops the spacecraft from having a little bit of side thrust out of an ion engine and therefore tumbling, if you know what I mean? Go ahead.
Yeah, I don't know if they're steerable or not. I don't know what kind of, if they have any linkages attached to it, or maybe it's done, electronically, you know. You know, with the way the xenon gas is coming out of there, I don't know. I know the angle of the engines are, you know, definitely offset to one another. So, you could set up the which way it's going to go with the hydrazine engines. You know, they have small thrusters, or even they might have momentum wheels or something. They'll set it up and then they'll fire the engine and leave it on like that for months on end. I guess if it's going out of, if it's going off, maybe they could, you know, change that, you know, with the magnet torquers or whatever they have on board to make fine adjustments. Back to you, Dick.
When they use the ionic engine, to leave the first asteroid in order to go to the second, I can see how you would blast in a particular direction so that the orbit around the first asteroid gets larger and larger. But in theory, that orbit never really leaves that asteroid. I wonder, when they got it up to a very high altitude, did they then use the other thruster for a quick blast in order to really leave the orbit of the first asteroid in order to aim toward the second asteroid? Because as I see it, if you did it with pure ionic engine, you got a slowly expanding orbit. How do you know what direction you're going to leave that first asteroid to go toward the second one? WS2N, K2RIW.
I know it was done all with the ion engines, so they must know how much time they have to leave each, you know, each ion engine on, whichever one they're using at the time, or, you know, I mean, days or weeks or months or whatever it is to deorbit the first one. You know, it goes down as the first spacecraft, goes down on record as the first spacecraft to orbit one object in space, deorbit, and then orbit another object. You know, unless you're, you know, I mean, even with the Apollo missions, when they came back, you know, they came in a direct shot, so you can't say they orbited the moon and they came back here and orbited the Earth. So they actually get the credit for being the first spacecraft to do something like that. WS2N.
Go ahead,
Wes.
Okay, there was a time when we were pretty much amazed that we've Hubble Space Telescope and the telescope. However, the analysis done by VAR, spectrometry, the spatial resolution is much better than that one that we can get out of the Hubble Space Telescope or any other telescope. So probably that was why they decided to use this kind of instrument on board of the spacecraft. Further down, they say that probably regional trends can be derived this way, waiting for the higher resolution coverage that eventually is achieved at later stages of the mission. So there are some drawbacks, but definitely they are able to get variable phase angles and illumination conditions. They are able to specify heliocentric distances also, and due to the VAR mapping, they have been able to, you remember the Vesta, and you remember the Rosetta Stone, the water sport, 2011-2012. So at first they tried that on this, and during close flyby on asteroid 21, which is Lutetia, that was 2010, they tested it and they found how it behaves and how can to rely on the data. There was another showroom of Grashenko a mapping phase that was on Comet 67P. That was 2014. That allows simultaneous retrieval of the surface temperature and emissivity. And that was 4.5 to 5.1 micrometer red. So when you're talking about the micrometers, you're talking about extremely low frequency of infrared. However, the measurement of that light was made in the few areas that was visible light and was the infrared. This thing is much better than the visible light for that purpose. So say we operate in 4.5 to 5.1 millimeter range, which is much below the visible light, and then we would be able to find all dominated fluctuation of the thermal emission from the spectrometer, and retrieve the temperatures, which actually gives us a lot of information what is on the surface. However, VIR cannot measure temperatures on the night side of the spheres as well in the north polar region that will undergo permanent shadow condition throughout the down nominal orbital mission phases. I'm not sure, and I would like to ask a poll as far as the threat, it could be something that is taken out of the body, but it could be something that is sent to the body and then eventually returned from the body. Are we able to find out what is beneath the surface because of that? So Paul and John and eventually Dick, do you have anything to say in this area? And Dick, see ya.
I'm not really sure of the question, so that's kind of stuck with that. By the way, I checked my notes. Net 173, a while back, we had a topic about Dawn. And it's 64 feet. I said 60 feet. It's 64 feet long on the solar panel, the total length back here.
John, can you translate it for me? What would be like of any sort that is beneath the surface to eventually being spotted based on the infrared? We're talking about the radio waves, guys. You're supposed to be knowledgeable in it. Whether the radio wave in form of infrared is reflected or is just transmitted out of the body. John, translate it to me so everybody understands.
I think Dick understands the question. You're asking about infrared radiation from the body, the human body. Is that what you're speaking about? Is it generated or is it reflected? Is that the question?
I'm talking about a solar body. I was talking about a planet, Sirius. And I was asking, would we be able to find, based on any information gathered by the infrared coming from the body, which means from the planet, about what is beneath, what is the temperature of the water? So that was my question, if anybody didn't understand. We have a radio wave. So, based on the wavelength of the radio wave, are we shooting it from the sun or from any the source towards the planet, and then we're reading that infrared radiation? How we can distinguish between what is coming out of it, what is reflected, and what is reflected, and to see it?
Okay. Well, as you know, if it's above absolute zero, it's radiating infrared. So what they can tell from that, I'm not sure. Maybe Dick can answer that question. Go ahead, Dick, KC2WGB.
I think it's called the Wien displacement law. If you know the physical temperature of an object, and if you know something about its surface its surface emissivity, then know with pretty good accuracy the curve of radiation versus wavelength that will come out of it. As the object gets hotter, it radiates more energy at all wavelengths, but the peak wavelength moves toward shorter wavelengths as you go to hotter frequency, higher temperatures. By using infrared, I think you can do a pretty good job of measuring the temperature of the surface of this asteroid. But whether or not you've got enough transparency of that surface so that using your infrared instrumentation, can you measure the temperature of what's below the surface, I'm doubtful of that. I think by knowing the surface temperature, by knowing the diameter, you can make some guesses as to what percentage of the energy, what percentage of the energy you measure coming off the surface is solar reflectivity versus internal emission. So by doing that comparison, you can make some good guesses as to how exothermic is the planet, is the asteroid. Is there a nuclear source down at its core, for instance? The Earth, for instance, is giving more giving off more energy than it absorbs because of the nuclear reaction taking place at our core. So, Paul, have the Dawn people made any pronouncements along these lines where they can predict the percentage of energy coming off of Sirius versus that which is reflected? Is it an exothermic heavenly body? WS2N, K2LIW.
I don't know. I know they extrapolate like what you were saying. They know how the diameter. They know pretty much now what it's made of, and they'll work it out that way. But yeah, I was saying before I found back last year we did a one piece on the TechNet about Dawn, and I found the solar cells were 64 feet long. I was saying 60 feet. But I just read through this again. It was the amp hours on the battery is 35 amp hours capability. But and if you had it in orbit around the Earth, it would be 10 kilowatts. So you could drop it off from there. I think it's probably, you know, the square of that. You know, maybe I guess they're happy if they get 2,000 kilowatts out of it with the solar panels. That far out. So that's it. I don't have any information on the science end of it, what they're using. I'd have to research the instruments on board and go through all of that. Compared to a human body, is that what Wesley was asking? I don't know. Back to you, Dick.
One more interesting information.
Paul, do we know how many kilowatts or how many amperes the ionic engine consumes? How about you, Paul?
How many pounds? They had almost 1,000 pounds of xenon gas on board. That's a lot, you know. You think, oh, it's a little gas they're shooting out of that thing. It's almost, I think, 900 and something pounds, but, you know, close to 1,000 pounds of loaded up with the xenon fuel. I mean, that's the weight of it. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, but how many amperes or how many kilowatts does the ionic engine consume when it is running? How much electrical power does it consume, Paul? Go ahead.
I don't have that. I have the amp hours on the batteries, 35 amp hours. It's quite a bit. And I can tell you how big the engines are. You know, the thrusters are 13 inches long by 12 inches in diameter. They consume... Oh, I don't know. I don't know. They break it down. I don't know. I'm not sure. I'd be curious to see how many amps of power that each ion engine uses. And you asked me before, is this the first one? They had another one called SMART, S-M-A-R-T. That was the first one that they used with ion engine. And I think the Neo spacecraft. Engine on it. Now a lot of them do. Even the ones going to geosynchronous orbit have them. It's quite popular. The Hayabusa from Japan that went out to an asteroid, and then there's Hayabusa 2 that also has it. So yeah, they're all starting to run these ion engines now. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, I think Wes said he's got one last question. Go ahead, Wes.
It's interesting how listeners attention could be activated. Some of unconforming information, but conform in terms of the picture. Geometrical shapes, but and presence of equal sort of domes. The scale of the picture is that each one of the domes is about one football place big. That could be nicely seen, and there is a number of the straight lines and the number of concentration of sort of domes on the surface of it. So, not saying anything more, apart from could be observed, but it's interesting. Enjoy to you.
Okay, thank you for that, Wes. I think it's time we're very late to go to the mailbag. KC2WGB, K2LIW, go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Nick, we have to go right over to Paul because I was talking to him early in the week and he needs more time. He's got a lot of stuff on his shelf there, so I'll hold this till next week. Nothing in a big rush, so let's go over to Paul and get some good information. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
You've got it, Paul.
Okay. Very good. I feel like we did the space portion already, but I nothing on Dawn. It was very good. Wesley that had that, but there are always updates, and good to find somebody that's interested in the science. I'm more interested in how they get there and how they get away from these different locations, what type of rockets and all. But the science end of it, you really could get involved. For instance, the Curiosity this week is digging up some sand on Mars, and it's called, there's something called the Chimer instrument on board. You know, you talk about these science things, and it's another acronym, you know, Coalition of Handling for In-Situ Martian Rock Analysts. I mean, they have these big long words, and basically it's a heater that heats things up, heats sand up, and they have all kinds of detectors on board that to figure out what the soils are made of. But they're having a problem with that unit. This is only the second time since 2012 since they landed there that they used this particular type of unit for a sample of sand that they picked up with the scooper. Usually they'll drill it with a rock. They'll take the dust from the rock, or they'll run a test that way. But I think maybe the sand particles were too big or something. So they're working on that. So Curiosity is a halt for now until they work that problem out. This week, on Wednesday anyway, they're going to do another EVA, but this time it's on the Russian side. They're going to go out and do a five-hour spacewalk, and NASA televises it. It's part of the International Space Station. So, you know, we'll get more details on how that works out next week, but they'll actually start televising it at 7:30 in the morning on Wednesday on the NASA channel. So they'll exit. They have their own way to get through their EVAs. They go out on the Poisk module. It's one of the Russian modules, like we have the Quest module. They have their own as well. Dropped it. I just want to bring up a flight that took off from Russia with a Proton rocket. And, you know, they have it's a communication satellite basically going to geosynchronous orbit. So it successfully did that. Even so, Russia is, you know, when they launch something, it starts off at 51 degrees. This one was set to go at 12 degrees inclination with a lot of orbital changes. They eventually get to a transfer orbit, and they're able to do that. But the interesting thing on board I was captivated by is something called the EDRS, E-D-R-S system, the European data relay system. It's very similar to a tracking data relay system that we use, or have been using since the 1980s. But this is it's a prototype. It's going to be all laser, so you'll be able to do, you know, 100 times faster transfer of information using laser instead of RF. So this thing's going to, it's part of the satellite, and they're going to pick up signals from low-orbiting satellites. There's two satellites in orbit now that the European Space Agency has up there. deal with Russia to launch these satellites. So not only are they going to get information from low orbiting satellites, which is a tough deal. You have to be right on looking at the satellites to pick up the signal. Eventually, probably within a year or so, they'll be receiving signals from ISS, one of the modules on board called Columbia. That's Columbus module is European Space Agency contribution. One of their modules are on the space station. It's large, it's like 30 feet long and 14 feet in diameter. And they're going to put one of these transmitting devices into operation. They'll be able to send signals up to EDIS, the EDIS system. And eventually, NASA has plans, probably about 3 years from now, to send up their own laser system. In the long run, probably many years from now, we'll eventually phase out a lot of the use of the TDRS satellite. I don't see that happening anytime soon, but, maybe, 10, 15 years down the road, who knows, the capabilities of the of these units. It's been tested before. We actually sent the spacecraft to the moon a few years back and transmitted data all the way from the moon to Earth. And but of course, it's going to really pay to have it in geosynchronous orbit with all the science and everything that come off the space station and all the satellites. They all want to get real time. Some of the information is transmitted back RF. Takes hours, to get information, and it's already old news by the time they look at it. With the laser system, it could be, 10, 15 minutes down the road, and they can get live video data of eventually drones. They want to have drones be able to send signals up to geosynchronous orbit. So it's interesting communications when I see that. Being a ham, my ears go up. Back to you for now, Dick. A couple more things if you want to cover. This is WS2M.
What you call a drone going up to geosynchronous orbit, the things that we call drones on the surface of the Earth are these things with four or six or eight propellers, and they're thrusting with air. I'm a little curious as to why you would call a thing that goes to geosynchronous orbit a drone, when the only way you can do any thrusting is with something that looks like a rocket engine. Over to you, Paul.
No, when I said drones, I'm talking about drones, in the atmosphere. This is it's actually a part of the European system. The Europeans have a defense mechanism going on. For instance, all these refugees coming into the different countries now, and they'd like to be able to keep track on this a little bit better. They presently use drones flying in the atmosphere, and they would have eventually liked to get information from these drones sent up to satellites. From what I was reading, to these particular satellites, these EDIS European data relay satellites, to help out their military. I'm sure I wouldn't be surprised if we're doing the same thing already. a lot of satellites are launched by our own military. But that type of thing. That's down the road. Right now, they'll be happy to get their Sentinel satellites already in orbit by the European Space Agency. Already have the transmitters on board, and they'll start testing them probably within a month or two once the first EDRIS satellite gets into operation. Back to you, Dick, then we'll talk about a new airlock they want to put on the International Space Station. I thought it was also a pretty interesting story here.
Yeah, the last airlock we were worried about, how many